Hey y'all, welcome to the third installment of our series called The Grab Bag. This episode is actually going to have five segments rather than three, so buckle your seatbelts. This episode is just called The Grab Bag Part 3. Let's get started. So, the first thing I was going to mention is to clarify that in my DEI episode, when I said that Jews and Asians were the cats of DEI, what I actually meant was that when it comes to the topic of Asians and Jews, DEI advocates are like cats, because cats are notorious for not knowing where they want to go or what they want to do or what they want. And when it comes to Asians and Jews, DEI advocates are like cats, because on the one hand, the Asians and Jews are allowed to have their student organizations on campus without everybody throwing a big old fit. And we all know that if there was a white student organizations on campus, the DEI advocates would have not just one cow, they'd have a whole herd of them. And at the same time, the Asians and the Jews are unfortunately mistreated by the DEI advocates, because for the Asians, it's in the form of diversity quotas, especially when affirmative action was in effect, because a lot of Asians would have very high test scores, because Asians are known for studying hard for a variety of reasons. It's not a stereotype, it's just the truth. And it's admirable to want to, you know, study hard and get a good test score and get into a school that you know is very hard to get into, but that you want to go there. You have a lot of dedication and determination that goes into that, no matter what race you come from. And so it's very sad when people are kept out of their dream schools after doing all that work just because of the race that they are and the color of their skin, and where their parents or grandparents came from. And so you would have a lot of Asians that would apply to their dream schools and would not get in because the schools wanted to make room, so to speak, for other minority students. And then when it comes to the Jews, on campus especially, but also in major cities like New York, they've had to endure anti-Semitic protests. And when I say protests, I'm thinking of like people waving signs and saying things that are very hateful. Like, for example, the notorious From the River to the Sea chant that basically advocates the extermination of Israel. But these more violent demonstrations that are also called protests by a lot of people, but I would actually argue should be called riots instead, where people set up tents or start like attacking Jews, they start like burning or looting or doing things like that. Jews have been the victims of that too, and of threats, sometimes credible threats, to their safety that have prevented them from going to class or going to work. And so that's why I say that when it comes to these groups, DEI people are like cats, because on the one hand, they allow those groups to have some of the benefits that the favored groups, according to DEI experts, which would be like the black people, Hispanics, Indians, that sort of thing. Such as being able to have their own campus organizations and whatnot. But on the other hand, the same DEI crowd looks the other way when those people are either denied entry into schools they worked hard to get into, or, on a more serious note, are attacked by those, sometimes those same advocates or groups that those advocates support, because of their ethnicity. And actually, I would say that Asians, you know, they kind of, unlike the Jews, the left did actually stand up against real and imagined Asian hate in the wake of the supposed COVID pandemic. There was this, even this hashtag going around, Stop Asian Hate, which I'm not sure how much of that supposed hate actually happened. I'm sure every one of these mass hysterias has some sort of kernel of truth to it, but to what extent it was actually happening, I don't know. So, with that out of the way, let's move on to the next topic. The next topic is yet another argument for the right to life. I am very passionate about increased accessibility for people with disabilities. I don't know, I don't think that the government should necessarily intervene and force that. I don't think that the government should play such a helicopter parent role in our lives, but I do think that we should have more accessibility. We should have more initiatives that try to make life more accessible for people with various disabilities. And I'm not only passionate about that because I happen to have low vision, but I'm also passionate about that because I've seen how hard it can be for people with other disabilities, hearing, cognitive, mobility. And so I wish that life was a little bit more accessible for them too. When it comes to like the workforce and, events and other areas of life. And you can't, in my view, you can't be truly passionate about accessibility for people with disabilities if you are not passionately for giving them a chance at life just like everybody else. A lot of disabilities are not detected or diagnosed until after the child is born, but unfortunately, when some are figured out in the womb, you have these women that decide to kill the child rather than taking care of it, him or her. For example, if a child is diagnosed with Down syndrome, sometimes the woman will have the child killed in the womb rather than wanting to take care of a child with Down syndrome. And I have met people with Down syndrome. They are some of the happiest and nicest people you'll meet, even if they may have challenges with, you know, cognition, speech, stuff like that. Everybody has challenges. Everybody has flaws. And in my view, it is not that much different to kill a child in the womb because he was diagnosed with Down syndrome than if a mother killed her 7-year-old daughter because she wasn't reading at grade level. We would all agree that if a mother killed her 7-year-old daughter because she wasn't reading at grade level, that mother would and should be at least imprisoned, I would argue executed, for committing such a heinous crime. So why should it be any different if a mother has a child in the womb that is diagnosed with a genetic disability or some other lifelong problem and decides she doesn't want to deal with it, and not only doesn't want to deal with it, but doesn't want to give that child a chance at life? Not only is that an infringement on his right to life, which by extension is an infringement on his right to liberty, and is directly going against God's plan, because God made those people that way to begin with. He can heal them in this life, and sometimes he does. I believe he'll heal me. I believe he's doing that right now. And even if he don't heal them in this life, he'll heal them in the next life. That's what scriptures would say. So when a mom kills a child in the womb because that child is diagnosed with a disability, she's interfering with God's plan. She's arguing with God. And that is wrong. So our next topic is kind of a short one. It's just something I've noticed, which is that when people try to argue about the merits of historical precedents and historical like ideas, they sometimes do so while not acknowledging the fact that words can change meaning over time. A couple of examples would be that in the King James Version of the Bible, the word conversation, we know that conversation today means like when people are talking about something. You know, if I sit down with Bob, we have a conversation. But back then, the word conversation meant like the way people live. Your conversation was the way you live. It wasn't just referring to like what comes out of your mouth. And another example is, and this is one I've come across more, especially in the political sphere, is when people talk about the Second Amendment, a lot of liberals will forget that when the Second Amendment refers to a well-regulated militia, it does not mean a militia that has a bunch of legal regulations on it. What it refers to is a militia that practices regularly. If you practiced regularly back then, you were referred to as regulators or as regulars, or not regulators, but you regulated. I misspoke there. You were regulars. That word regular has changed its meaning over time somewhat, and the word regulate as well. They come from the same root. And so the phrase well-regulated militia, all it means is a militia that practices often, practices regularly. It does not mean a militia with a bunch of rules on it. Now, granted, these militias were governed by some rules, like you don't just kill people indiscriminately, but those are moral rules. Those are not rules that the government necessarily had to lay down. So the idea that that clause supports the idea that the Second Amendment should be regulated into oblivion is frankly ridiculous. And that kind of dovetails into my next point, which is the way that we understand rights has been distorted by the left. Because what a right truly is something given by God. A right is given by God. That's where our rights come from. For example, the right to life, the right to self-determination, the right to free speech, the right to bear arms, the right to not be unreasonably searched, as in the Fourth Amendment. Those are rights given to us by God. And so what the left wants us to think is that rights come from the government. And not only the left here, but the left in a lot of other countries wants their people to think that rights come from the government and thus can be taken away by the government as well. North Korea has a constitution, and that constitution grants a right to faith, for example. But if you try to practice your faith in North Korea, you're probably going to end up in a gulag. So the fact of the matter is that our rights do not come from the government, and therefore the government cannot take them away, as hard as it may try. But the left wants us to think that they do, which is one of the many ways that the left wants us to rely only on the government. And that's been kind of the mindset that's been pushed on our throats since probably the 1860s, at least. Actually, I would say that's a pretty good estimate for when that really started. I mean, there were people who believed that, or at least would say similar things before that. Like, if you notice, the left like reveres Alexander Hamilton, even though he was a communist. But anyway, so that leads me then to my final point. which is centralization. I previously said in an episode about families, when talking about the vice presidential debate, that childcare is one of the many issues where government centralization assumes people will all do things one way, and that's not the case. And that a fundamental aspect of centralization is the assumption that everybody will do things one way, whether that's the way they already do them or whether that's because the program pushes them to do it that way. And I can think of even a better example than childcare. That example is Social Security. And it does this in a few ways. First, some background. When the Social Security program was first started, life expectancy was about 65. That's why the age of 65 was put into place, because that was the life expectancy of the time. Now, life expectancy depends somewhat on the source, but it's generally greater than 75, and sometimes it's over 80. It also depends on whether you're looking at the whole average of the U.S. population or whether you're looking at various demographics. For example, women tend to live longer than men. How you eat, how you exercise, those can also play a part. I don't have much trust in the psychology industry, but even they will acknowledge that people who are spiritual, at least. Now, I would say there's only one true faith, as I've said many, many times, and will probably say many, many more. But even the psychology people agree that people that are spiritual have a spiritual connection to something greater than themselves tend to live longer as well. There's even some research that leads to the suggestion that coffee helps you live longer. There are so many factors. So the idea that we can have one uniform life expectancy is itself kind of ridiculous, but I can see why it's developed. It can be a benchmark. However, 65 is not the life expectancy by any source you look at today. Maybe in some parts of Africa, but here it's not. So 65 now is kind of an arbitrary age to set that. But what happens is, because the Social Security program is structured in such a way that you don't get your full benefits until you're 65 or sometimes 66, that somewhat pushes people, not only pushes them physically to wait to retire until that point, even though some people could and probably should, for health reasons, retire earlier, depending on the line of work they're in and how much they saved and all that. And some people actually do retire at 62 or earlier. But Social Security pushes people to retire at 65 or 66. And that has some psychological implications too, because sometimes that push is not just from the way the program is designed. It's also from this now popular conception that people need to retire at 65. There was a time in history, for most of human history, there was really no such thing as retirement, really. I mean, when you got old and sick, people took care of you and they respected you and they looked to you for wisdom. But even then, you still played a role in the community, even if that role was more advisory. But there was no set age. It wasn't like if a family all lived on the farm, the minute grandpa turned 60, he stopped helping plant the crops. It wasn't like that, really. Retirement is a somewhat new concept. And it can be bad for people. Because it's one thing if you stop working. I'm not saying people are machines and should just work to the bone. I do think that people are much more than that. And I think the idea that people should just be seen as laborers or consumers is a byproduct of the same leftist mind virus that has been inflicting a lot of damage on population since the 1860s. However, and sometimes before. However, that being said, God did make man to work. God does give people callings. I think most people actually have several callings, even if some are more public than others, even if some are more connected to the world than others. I don't think everything you do is a calling, but I think most people have multiple callings, multiple passions, multiple places where they play a role, an important role. Or even if it's not an important front-facing role, it's still an important role. I mean, the person who helps clean the church does play an important role, even if nobody ever sees them doing it. That's just one small example. So where am I going with this? Well, the problem is when people retire, but they don't have such a thing to drive them forward. They don't have that force to drive them forward, whether it be a hobby or an increased involvement in their family, holding the family together and all that, or whether it be involvement with the church or with some cause that they're passionate about politically or a sport that they enjoy, maybe. Like, I know a lot of older people that are into pickleball, for example. When they don't have something like that that keeps them going, they succumb to inertia. And this not only, like, when you sit around and do nothing, not only does that affect you psychologically, but that can also affect you physically, not just because you're inactive and it causes heart problems and causes you to gain weight and all that, but also because a lot of times your stress levels and your unhappiness can manifest themselves in physical ways, in physically detrimental ways. And as I said, I don't have much trust in the psychology industry, but I do acknowledge that when you succumb to inertia and that affects your mental health, as it generally does, then that will affect your physical health. And that is part of why so many people who retire but have nothing else driving them forward once they leave the job, that's why so many of them end up dead within like 10, 15 years. And I think that's going to become an increasing problem once the current generation gets older and retires, and once the millennials get older and retire. Because in my generation and the millennials, you have an increasing amount of people who have no connection to a church. They've chosen not to have children. They've chosen, in some cases, not even to get married. The main thing that they seem to be tied to is, like, the internet. And some of them don't even have jobs to begin with. But the ones who do, when they retire, what are they going to have? I mean, they're not going to have a family to be increasingly involved in because they don't have kids. They just have cats, and cats only live like 15 years. So they won't have a church to be involved in unless they get saved later in life. There's always hope. But if they don't, they won't have a church to be involved in either. And they don't have a lot of hobbies, really, except for maybe some of them play video games, but a lot of them, you just scroll TikTok all day, and that's not a hobby. So this problem of people retiring and then succumbing to inertia is only going to get worse once these generations retire. So, thank you so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, or at least become a bit more informed by it, or at least seen it as some food for thought, because there were some things covered today that'd be more food for thought than absolute fact. You can find us on Spotify, Amazon Music, the RSS feed, iHeartRadio, and Pandora. You can also contact us on our Facebook page, Jesse's Fireside Chats, or on X at JFSCpod. And if you want to send us an email, you can do so at jessesfiresidechats@gmail.com. That's JESSEAS firesidechats@gmail.com. And feel free to pass this along to anybody you know that might be interested. And I hope you'll come back next time. Have a blessed day.